Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 410 of Her, the podcast, where you're going to hear the truth about her mind, her body, her life, and her fitness with a little twist here. How about that little exercise obsession? We'll get to this. This is going to be such a fabulous episode. Before we begin, just know that we need to give a shout out to our wonderful sponsor. It's Solaray Vitamins, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y Vitamins. Yeah. I know you try to get in your vitamins, minerals, or all your vegetables and fruits, and you never get a chance to do that. You know how it goes. It's like, oh my gosh, it's all takeout time. So to help fill in those gaps, especially on days when we don't get what we need nutritionally, just know that Solaray Vitamins, the multivitamins for women, were especially formulated for women. So run on over to Solaray.com and learn more. And here's your first reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show, because my team and I are just sitting around waiting for your feedback. We love to hear from you. All right, it's time for Her.
The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind. Her body. Her life. It's all about her.
Okay, can I just say how excited I am about this episode? Because you all know I'm a senior Olympic triathlete. I'm like a nutcase about fitness. And it goes on and on. And then this book comes along. OMG. And if you don't get it, you're a total loser. All right, so it's called Fit Nation, The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession. Okay, you got me at exercise obsession, and so there you have it. And I have now read God knows how many reviews of this book because of the very, very provocative titles. Now, who wrote this thing? Well, Natalia Melman Petrozella. Natalia is a historian of contemporary American politics and culture. And good luck with that one. Boy, is that keeping you busy lately with all the crazy things going on out there. She is associate professor of history at the New School, co-founder of the wellness education program Health Class 2.0, and a premier leader of the mind-body practice Intensati. Her work has been supported by, oh my goodness gracious, Rockefeller Mellon Foundations. She has a baccalaureate in art from Columbia University and a PhD from Stanford. Since I'm from Berkeley, I'm going to try to forgive you for that. A PhD from Stanford, and lives with her husband and two children in New York City. Okay, now, Natalia, first of all, right off the bat, welcome to the Her podcast. I'm so excited. Number one.
I'm so excited too. Sorry to interrupt now, you, but I'm that excited.
I know. Now tell us all about your fitness background.
Yeah. So it started probably not like you at all, because you're a decorated athlete. I was intimidated by everything physical growing up. I was this super bookish kid. I was really humiliated in PE class, last kid picked for the team, all of that. And I thought like that was just my luck in life. And then because I was so humiliated in PE, I actually figured out in my junior year of high school, you could do an independent study. This is like 1994, 95. And they said, well, it just has to be supervised. It can't be a team sport. I'm like, don't worry about that. And so I basically, So I went to a group fitness class. I didn't know what that was, but I knew that it was better than like failing the rope climb again. And then it was really interesting. It was step aerobics. I went in there. I was the youngest by like 10, 15 years. And I was like, I don't know what this is, but I love it. And it was like the beginning of my life as a gym rat, I guess. And then after that, I was just trying to get in the gym as much as I could. I worked behind the desk. I later became certified to teach this class in Intensati. And yeah, so I'm a professor, but I've also had this kind of double life as a fitness instructor too.
Now, didn't you do something with Equinox?
Yeah, I worked at Equinox for years. That was actually when I got certified in this program in Tensati. The woman who founded it was like one of the key leaders at Equinox in group fitness. And so I auditioned there, and that was the first place really that I taught. So yeah, I taught there for almost 10 years.
Oh my gosh. So I've known their CEO for over 20 years.
Oh.
So Harvey Spivak and I are dear friends.
Oh, cool.
And I'm on their global health and exercise as advisory board with all kinds of crazy people on that. And so we've had a lot of fun over the years.
So cool.
And I've spent more time than I can count at Equinox, except for the lockdown when that little Hummer in my neck of the woods in the Northeast was closed for a year and almost a year and a half. Unbelievable.
Oh, I remember. Well, now I'm a member, and I was that person who lined up at 5:45 in the morning, like the first day that the gym opened, to get back in there.
What I ended up doing was I built my own damn gym in my home. I said, we're not going through that again, and just waiting for the next pandemic. I mean, I'm just, you know, right. Usually I'm much more optimistic, but I don't know. Anyway, so wow. So you've got street creds when it comes to fitness. You do. You're not some academician who's just sitting around going, I'm bored today. Let's write about exercise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us why you actually wrote this book.
Totally. So I was at this really interesting point in my life where I'd been teaching group fitness while I was getting my PhD, writing my dissertation. I had gotten married like a year or two before. I was pregnant with my first kid, and I was about to get a tenure track job in history, which is actually still the job that I have today. And all these people in both of those worlds were telling me like they knew what I should do next. Like the people, like my parents, the people in academia were like, okay, you had this like cute little fitness habit while you were in grad school. Now you're a big girl. Time to like quit that and have your big girl professor job. Like, you know, those were the old days. And I'm like, no way. This is so important to my life. Like, I need this. And similarly, the people at the gym, like, who were so kind, were like, you clearly love fitness so much. Like, why are you in this boring professor job? Like, you're going to be teaching history. How boring is that compared to this? And why don't, you know, I'll help get you clients. You can get all these other certifications. And I also was like, that is not right for me either. Like, I actually really love both of these things, and I need to find a way to bring them together. And it wasn't clear how they would come together at that point, like a history professor and a fitness instructor. And so the first thing that I did was not write this book. The first thing that I did is I teamed up with this food access activist, Ellen Gustafson, who's an old friend of mine from college. And we were at that point, this is like early 2000s or like 2010 or so, we were really concerned with like the way that this growing wellness space around fitness and healthy food was so elite. Like, there I was teaching at Equinox. I was a Lululemon ambassador. Kale basically was shorthand for upper crust. And we were like, this is so messed up. You know, we want to do something about it. So we started by creating an experiential wellness program in New York City schools, working with my college students and New York City PE teachers and like health professionals to do that. And that was kind of my first foray. And then within a couple years, I'm like, oh my God, the gym is this, like the gym broadly construed, is this fascinating place that historians really haven't looked at that closely. And certainly historian fitness instructors haven't looked at that closely. And so I kind of dived in that way. And that was the beginning. And that was like practically 10 years ago.
Oh my God. So how long has this book been in process?
Almost a decade, like not full time because I teach full time and I have two kids and other things in my life. So I never had full time writing like book leave. But yeah, I've been doing interviews and research and presenting on it and trying to figure it out for like almost a decade.
I just thought the book was so badly needed.
Thank you.
You know, I'm currently on the board of trustees of the American College of Sports Medicine. I have been working with them, oh my God, for three decades at least. And I listen to this. I'm immersed in both the academics yep. as well as just the practical day-to-day. I mean, I'm out there in the front trenches getting sweaty and dirty with the best of them. And yep. I've observed a lot of the same stuff, the Kale Tribe and yeah. all the rest of it. And there's something that's just, it wasn't right. Things didn't seem right to me. So your book is exquisitely timely given our times when all the gyms closed down, who can access what, back and forth. So in the book itself, which I just found superb.
Thank you.
No, I don't say that lightly. You don't want to be on my bad end either. So I just like, wow, this is trash. No, but excellently written.
Thanks.
So you have a chapter here that I just love. It's chapter 2. It's called No More Fat Cats or Ladies of Leisure. Tell us what was going on in that chapter.
Yeah, so provocatively titled. I'm glad that landed for you. But that's a chapter about like the early 20th century and really this big shift in kind of ideal body types. And what I'm talking about there is the shift from this positive association with fatness. And I don't say that in a negative way, just in a descriptive way, but that positive association with bigger bodies as indicating high social status. So at that point, if you were a fat cat or you looked like a lady of leisure, you were displaying in some ways that you were not doing manual labor. You had time to like hang around and you had access to rich caloric food. And that was actually seen pretty positively. And so I go into like all these kind of crazy historical things. Like there were these fat men's clubs and they would describe in the newspaper that like all these jolly, well-dressed fat men would come together and all of like the bony, thin, poor people would look on from this outside, like because they didn't have enough food and they were working hard all day. And it's so different from today where obesity often tracks with lower socioeconomic status. And so part of what I'm trying to show there is that you have this really big shift that after industrialization, when it's actually much easier to have access to caloric food, much cheaper eventually too, and where we transition to a service economy where more people are doing sedentary work, then what is desirable and what looks like a kind of more upper class body is having the discipline to resist those pleasures, right? To resist caloric food because everyone has access now. And so, yeah, so that's a big shift in like ushering in this time when working out is seen as something that makes you virtuous.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, doesn't make you just virtuous. So in part 2 of your book, this is called Slimming the Soft American. Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the little statement below, no one gets cut from the squad of fitness. And this is from the Presidential Council on Youth Fitness from 1960, I believe. And so you have a chapter there called Fitness Makes Us Strong, Not Soft. Tell us what that's about, because, you know, I'm laughing a little bit about the word soft. I mean, we're seeing this so much more, this whole issue, Natalia, of softness. Like, you don't want to be soft. Ew, soft. What you want to be is hardcore. It's all about hard. Go hard. And there are now books out there saying that we have become, as a nation, soft mentally, spiritually, physically. That if any one of a number of people were thrown on a desert island, good flipping luck with that one, if you can survive at all. And we're coddled, and cuddled too, I guess, but we're coddled, right? And that we don't have enough physical challenge, mental challenge, maybe mental challenge at work or professional, whatever. But for physical challenge, for sure, we're not out there on a farm somewhere just getting up with the Tweety birds and collapsing later on in the day. Instead, we pay for that pleasure by actually paying dues to a gym, which is a box where we do farm work, basically is what it all boils down to. So tell us about Fitness Makes Us Strong, Not Soft.
Yeah. And so that's part of the heart of the book. And really the big shift that I'm tracking here is how did we get from a time then when exercise was considered weird in the United States, like in that fat cat era, like if you were someone who was going out and working out, like you were considered a health nut and like kind of suspicious. And then we get to today where we definitely don't have majority participation in exercise, but most people think exercise is like a good thing. Like when I tell people I'm writing this book, they're like, oh my God, I should work check out. I'm like, I'm not the police. It's fine. But we have that expectation, right? So in that chapter, what I'm trying to describe there is that one of the key moments or factors in that transition is the federal government saying, hey, you want to be a good American, you've got to exercise and be fit. And that comes about in the Cold War. So that's in the 1950s, early 1960s. I'm quoting JFK there with the soft American, where he comes on the heels of Eisenhower, who was really the first one to do it. And they basically come to this crazy realization that like rocks their world. They realize that all these things that make America's good life good, suburbs, cars, TVs, frozen food, non-agricultural economy, all those things are actually having a really negative effect on people's bodies. And so it's actually this homemaker, Bonnie Pruden, who's like an amazing pioneer, who brings this to the attention of the White House. And she's like, all these kids are getting literally soft, like they're flabby. And that's reflected in everything from their intellectual capacity to, and this is what gets their attention, their ability to serve in the military. That gets the attention of the White House. This nation of soft Americans is not going to be able to fight if the Cold War gets hot. And so that's when you have JFK writes this essay about the soft American in Sports Illustrated. And it really is this key moment in kind of positioning exercise and managing that bodily softness as a kind of national priority.
Well, do you kind of sit here now in the year 2023, and are you scratching your head as you're saying that and say, look where we are today?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting at that moment, because on the one hand, it's like, okay, great. Like the government was actually saying this is important. And like, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get behind some public policy to make physical fitness accessible and a national priority? And I definitely like, I'm a little nostalgic for that. On the other hand, you look a little harder at what those programs were like, and I'm not actually that nostalgic for it. Like, first of all, they never really invested in the infrastructure to create like a lot of public recreation or like great PE programs. Like, it was mostly a PR initiative, and they wanted local communities to fund them themselves. And then also the programs, there are still people around who think the JFK like phys ed years were like the best thing that ever happened. But honestly, like a kid like me would have been more traumatized. They were like very militaristic. They were mostly for boys. They divided you like very rigorously in terms of skill level. And so when I was interviewing older folks about this book, it was really interesting because a lot of them like immediately were like, oh, fitness, history? I was so traumatized by the presidential challenge or whatever. So I am scratching my head, but I'm not nostalgic for that time. I think we could learn from those lessons and do better.
I think that that's wonderful. You're also hinting at a theme we're going to be talking about in a little bit, which is, oh, the system is broken, but yeah. We will, we'll get to that in just a moment. So yeah, look at us today. The military recruiting is turning into a nightmare. They actually have, as it were, pre-recruitment kind of fat camps. I'm using the term euphemistically because that's what they were called. For people who really want to get in the military, but absolutely were too overweight to pass all the testing, of which there's quite a bit. And so look at us today. Are we too soft? Have we come full circle? What the heck just happened here as we're looking at all this? So kind of following on the heels of that, Natalia, you write in chapter 15, swap the fat for your true self. Mm-hmm. Okay, go for it.
Yeah, so those are my words I'm quoting there. And what I'm quoting there is a really famous book, which was called Fat as a Feminist Issue. It was published in the late 1970s. And one of the things that I think is so remarkable about that book is that it was supposed to be this like anti-diet book and like kind of pushing back at all of this kind of like very sexist diet literature, which was constantly telling women they needed to starve themselves, swallow tapeworms in order to be thin and pretty. And it pushes back on that. But what I found so interesting is it is like so not a 2023 text. Like if you had that perspective today, it would be like, love yourself just as you are. It's okay. We're all beautiful, body positive, etc. No. This book is like, The real reason that you're fat is because you're holding on to trauma of one sort or another. Maybe you were assaulted and you're using the fat as armor. Maybe you're like have low self-image. But the minute that you like step into your power, the fat will fall away and you will step into your true self. And so I talk about that book at some length and I quote that pretty provocative line because I think it's like represents definitely a moment in time when feminists were pushing back on all this like you have to be thin or you're worthless talk, but they were not doing so in the way that the body positive movement today is doing so. It's very, very different.
Yeah. So since you brought up the body positivity movement,
yeah,
what's your take on that? I mean, here you are, a fitness expert and someone who is also an academic, and you're watching all of this transpire right now. How do you feel about what, as it were, the body positivity movement means to you?
Yeah, I'm glad you frame it that way because sometimes I get asked that and I'm like, I'm not that kind of doctor. Like, you're that kind of doctor, right? But I do think it's a cultural movement. Like, the way that I think about this and all the caveats that I don't think I've ever encountered fat discrimination. I'm like relatively thin. And what I think is that it is a really good thing for us to draw attention to fat discrimination and fat hatred in our society. It is rampant, it's everywhere, it prevents people from getting good medical care, fair treatment at job interviews. Like, it really is a huge problem. At the same time, I also think obesity is a real problem. And I'm really troubled by the way that certain strands of this body positivity self-acceptance movement can almost move so far in the direction of saying that weight loss is never a positive goal, never a positive outcome. And I think that that's just not true for a lot of people in our society where the deck is stacked to make us carry more weight than is probably healthy. A lot of us could stand to lose some weight. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think we should be able to hold those two truths at once. We live in a very discriminatory society towards fat people, and that's really bad. And weight loss is something that is a reasonable goal for lots of people and need not be a symptom of that hatred.
I love that. And thank you, Natalia, for that. Since I am a doctor.
Yeah. I mean, you weigh in. I want to know what you think.
So what's fascinating here is, let's look at some statistics. Mm-hmm. I'm a clinical scientist, so I'm driven by metrics in addition to everything else. And that is, if we keep up at the rate we're doing right now with regard to more and more emergence of obesity in this country, and obesity really is roughly 50 pounds over prescribed, as it were, average weight for your height, mm-hmm, and age and gender and all the rest of this. And one of the things that comes to mind is that by 2030, over 50% or a majority of adults in the United States will be obese.
So disturbing.
Now, let's think about that for a second. So currently, and this has actually been true since 1997, the majority of adults in the United States are overweight. I mean, that could be fluffy. It could be 10 pounds, it could be 20 pounds, 25. All right. But obesity is a whole different ball game.
Yeah.
Right. That's 50 large on board. And that comes with its own issues. All right. So if that's really true, and right now we're at 2023, so we have 7 years here and things are getting kind of interesting, then how are we going to be defining fitness, softness, strength for a population that's majority obese? That means that people like you and I will be in the minority. Mm-hmm. And so now we have to get our brains out of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even 90s. And we have to now go to a bit of a different place. And we have to be absolutely real about what our world is like today. So I sit back and I say to myself, okay, we have built the infrastructure, all flawed, and it's a mess, that is obesogenic. Mm. It's not friendly. I mean, you and I both have to slug it out trying to make sure we eat healthfully and we get our exercise in, all the rest of it. Sometimes it's just plain not easy. And again, to the whole point of accessibility to the ability to even have some level of fitness and eating well and all the rest of it. That's a whole different conversation. So when I look at someone who is now 100 pounds over, which is becoming extremely common, on the one hand, I have extreme compassion because I know that this cannot be easy at multiple levels, mentally, physically, spiritually, otherwise. Physically, it's just harder. It is. And depending upon your age, it could be quite hard as you get older and all the rest of it. And how hard it is to reverse this. We as experts in this field say that the best thing in the world is never to become obese in the first place. Mm. And so I put so much of my money in prevention and being proactive and getting to kids and getting to teenagers and getting to young adults. Because by the time you do become an adult and you have this, it's work that you can most definitely do. But when you're more super obese, it now becomes a bit more problematic as we look at bariatric surgery, at drugs, and all kinds of things like this. And so I'm with you, Natalia. When you wrote in this book, and I'm probably going to quote this somewhere, that we have a broken system. We have a broken system that we don't make it easy for people to be healthy and fit. We don't. And yet we want them to be healthy and fit. We say, that's important. You should dress in this thing and back and forth and all the rest of it. You know, I look at Lizzo. I've been kind of following her. She's obviously an exceptionally talented singer and all the rest of it. She topped out at 308 pounds. Mm-hmm. And then she has now recently, again, I have no idea if things have fluxed again, but she recently took on more of a vegan program and she's dropped 60 pounds. But by my math, that's still well north of 200 pounds. And so then the question is, what now? And I have to give it to Lizzo. You rock on with your bad self, girlfriend, because she was absolutely motivated by health. And good for you, Lizzo, and wherever this is going to take you, and for really looking at that whole body positivity. But as a physician, I also am so terrified of the type 2 diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and the number one reason for knee replacements in this country is not football, it's obesity.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Knees are taking it, man, right and left. And, you know, now I'm going to shut up, but...
No, please don't. I'm learning from you.
Well, what do you think of what I just said, Natalia? This is a really cool conversation.
Oh, it's so cool. And I just love speaking with experts whose expertise is related on the topic, but so different because you're a clinician and you're deep in the data and you know the human body in a way that I do not. I mean, I agree with everything that you're saying. To me, like some of the points that are so crucial are that we've got to, as I was saying, acknowledge that overweightness, obesity are real issues. But I think one thing that we have not done as a culture at all is move that conversation away from the individualized victim blaming into the systemic critique. And that's not to like let people off the hook, but it's to say and acknowledge like there's a real reason that obesity rates are tied to socioeconomic status. It's freaking expensive to eat healthful food that will support a healthy body, weight just being one part of that. When you and I were joking at the beginning of the hour about like, oh, Equinox and building a home gym, like, of course, we're being lighthearted, but just think, I'm speak for myself, everything like implied in my situation. Oh, poor me. I signed up. I had to go wait in line at 5:45 at Equinox. I'm paying for an expensive gym. It's within walking distance from my house. I live in a domestic situation where my kids are taken care of in the morning so I can go out and work out. My job time, the way I work is in my control enough that I'm not working an overnight shift today and then I have to commute 3 hours tomorrow. Like those are all structural issues that make it very hard to lead a a healthful life that contributes to a healthy weight and other things. Weight is just really one of those things. And so I think we got to like both empower people and make them feel like every individual person deserves and can improve their health, but also not engage in this kind of victim blaming about like, oh, well, you didn't work out today or you're fat or you're this, you must just be lazy. And unfortunately in the fitness community, there is so much of that. Like, you didn't go running? What? All you need is willpower and a pair of sneakers. Get out there. And yeah, that's like a little bit true, but there's a lot more that shapes that decision of whether or not you can go running.
You're absolutely 100% correct. And as I think about this and what your book brings up so beautifully is that we need a different system. We have to have an infrastructure. Okay, if I was queen of the world, really, if I ruled the whole damn place, here's what I'd do. I'd have so many parks, your head would spin. Yes. I would have so many bike paths that are safe. I would have walking and hiking paths. I would have kids back doing recess and not with their faces stuck in a device. I would have rules about the devices. Absolutely. Get them out there playing and enjoying using their wonderful bodies, and also make after school sports and just fun stuff. It doesn't have to be like an organized softball team or something. It could just be fun stuff, accessible and free, or so cheap that anybody would be able to afford it, so that kids can fall in love with their bodies. Yeah. So that they can say, oh man, this is the best. Right now, the way kids are looking at it, physical activity and all that, because and hello parents out there who are doing this, they get this message from their parents that the most important thing to do is get into a top-level university. That's it. And who cares what happens to your body and all the rest of it, so long as your scores are just crushing it. Well, excuse me, if your body is not healthy and fit. And by fit, I don't mean you're some kind of crazy athlete. Yeah. I just simply mean that you're using your body, you're doing things in a very routine way, getting out, playing, throwing things, having fun with the family and friends.
Yeah.
Geez, what happened to all of that? Is it too late, Natalia?
I hope it's not too late. And a question that I often get and it's been really fun to think about is like in 30 years from now, when we look back on today, like what are we going to think was so crazy about our moment in fitness history? And one of the things when I'm feeling optimistic that I say is that I would love to look back on today and like treat it almost the way we look back at a time when like no one wore seatbelts and people smoked while they were like teachers were smoking in college, professors. While they were teaching classes, like how unhealthy that was and how our society and our laws allowed that to be. And I would love to look back at this time when it was like, oh my God, can you imagine there were like the majority of Americans didn't live within walking distance of a park? Can you believe we only had PE that felt like it was punishment where you have to like exercise because you were talking? Like, can you believe that? Like, I think that that would be such an exciting thing. And like, I do think that there is a lot more attention. People like you, people like me, who are talking about fitness as crucial to a life well lived, not just this like fun little leisure activity for people who are at the office all day or something silly that like women do in aerobics class. Like there is that aspect of it, which I think has sort of forestalled like real reform. No, people are talking about preventative health and behavioral change as so important. I mean, COVID, like this has been a really important thing in mitigating comorbidities. You know, and so I'm hoping that we can move towards policies and policies and practices that kind of uphold that importance rather than kind of acknowledging it and moving on to the next thing.
I love it. I really do.
Thanks.
I said this at the very beginning, and as we're wrapping this up, what I can tell you right now is that this book is exquisitely timely. It's timely all to sort of like, whoa, hit the pause button here. Put your Lululemons aside here for just a second. Okay, I'm so bad. And just say, number one, practice gratitude. If you can access a park, if you can access a school for your kids where they do have recess, they do have PE and all the rest of it. Practice gratitude, because you're someone who should be extremely appreciative of that.
Yep.
Because not everybody can do that. And whenever I talk about fitness, I also have to just at least do one liner about nutrition. You know, without one, forget the other.
Absolutely.
Okay. So as you said so well at the very end of your book, you can't really out-exercise, right? What did you say? Right. You can't
out-exercise. A broken system. A bad diet, a broken system. Yeah.
There you go. A bad diet. But you also said, yet you can't out-exercise a broken system. Mm-hmm. And that was the piece that was missing from so many other books out there and perspectives on this. And that is just calling out what it is. It's a broken system. And that we can do micro changes within our own communities. We can demand to have more bike and walking and hiking paths to be able to get people to enjoy the outdoors. How about we build more of these, preserve more of these forested areas and parks? Every time I'm in New York, of course, I run the New York Marathon, the rest of it. Nice. You know, and I know every damn inch of that damn park. I'm just saying that it is one of the most fabulous experiences for me to just get into the park.
I love it.
For me, it is absolutely where it belongs in a big way. So I think the book is timely. I think everyone out there should grab it. It's called Fit Nation. Just remember those two words, Fit Nation, and then The Gains and Pains of America's Exercise Obsession. It's so important for all of us to be able to embrace what this is all about in our lives. And the author is our wonderful guest today, Dr. Natalia Melman. And remember, I gave you that doctor, so you're going to have to love that
part.
Thank you. Okay, that's the MD part. I confer degrees as I go through this. Natalia, Dr. Natalia Melman Petrozella. I said it right. Yay.
You got it. My Czech husband will be very proud of you.
So I know. I'm saying, could you just come up with Smith or Jones or make my life easy? But no, it never works that way. And seriously, Natalia, I've just had an absolutely wonderful time with this episode.
Me too.
And thank you so much for taking the time. And you know I'm going to have to tap you for future episodes. You know that.
I would be honored. I loved our conversation, and maybe even one day in person, or at least video.
Oh my gosh.
On, right?
We're talking New York City. I'm just
Let's
saying.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
All right. We'll do it. And listen, everyone out there, please take a minute to hit iTunes and rate and review the show. My team and I are sitting around waiting to hear from you. We would love your feedback. And another marvelous shout out to Solaray Vitamins. Solaray.com is our terrific sponsor. Just run on over there, ladies, and have a little look at the multiple vitamins and all the other offerings just for you as a woman. Solaray.com. I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the Her Podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter and Instagram at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the Her Podcast on so many platforms, iTunes, Radio MD, Spotify, it goes on. Listen, thanks for being here today with us. Stay safe and stay well.